Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When you walk into a casino and lay your money down, you can't know if you'll win, even if you understand the game and the odds. What you do know for certain is that you're gambling, accepting the possibility of losing money in exchange for the possibility of gaining it. So what's the difference with playing the stock market? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Speculation offers return on investments rather than the possibility of winning. And unlike gambling, we tend to see speculation as a catalyst of productive activity somewhere, even if the investors aren't actually producing anything themselves. But whether we are collectively winning or losing on average, we Americans have a long history of ambivalence about market speculation because of the many things it does have in common with old-fashioned betting. Stuart Banner is professor of law at UCLA. His new book is called Speculation: The History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing. Stuart, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's set out some terms here. What are you referring to when you use the term speculation?
Well, that's actually been a hard question for a long time. I mean, maybe start with the extremes on both sides. There's always been agreement that investment is necessary. It's helpful. We should encourage it. And there's always been agreement on the other side that gambling is dangerous and we should discourage it. Now, speculation lies somewhere in the middle. It's a little bit like investing. It's a little bit like gambling. It has attributes of both. And so what to do about it has always posed a puzzle. You know, we've always had to draw a line between two kinds of risky commerce, a good kind we want to promote and a bad kind we want to deter, and it's never been an easy thing to do.
Well, what are the origins of our complicated relationship to gambling? If everybody understands the risks and plays by the rules, why do we view gambling as, by and large, an immoral activity?
Yeah, you know, there's a long tradition going back, it's older than the United States, of moral condemnation of gambling. And that, you know, that carried through to the early United States, and that's carried through basically through all of American history. Although, you know, to be fair, it's actually weakening now. I think that people are much more accepting of gambling, really, than they were at any time in American history.
One, I guess, historic concern about gambling is, you know, you imagine this is very stereotypical, but, you know, the dad going out and gambling a week's pay and then the rest of the family suffers. But realistically, the same thing can happen if mom or dad loses a lot of money in the stock market.
Right, and a lot of people have pointed that out, and so a lot of people, for centuries, people have on one side said that it's hypocrisy to condemn gambling when, you know, investment in the stock market or any other sort of asset poses the same risks. But then on the other side, people have criticized speculation in the stock market and other assets for posing the same risks as gambling. So people on both sides of the debate have made exactly that point.
You note near the beginning of the book that another moral concern is that speculators who are raking in large profits, focused on profit making, become somehow less sensitive to everybody else getting treated fairly. There's no longer a do unto others mentality.
Yeah, that's been a persistent theme in criticism of speculators, that speculation makes people greedy, makes them selfish, makes them think only of themselves.
So the very things that make speculation dangerous can also make it useful in markets and vice versa. How can speculation make markets more liquid, more stable? Tell us about that.
Okay, so it's been recognized for a very long time that speculators perform useful services in markets. That is, they make markets thicker, more liquid, in the sense that a person wanting to buy something, say a share of stock, will be more willing to buy it if they know that somewhere down the road there's someone to sell it to, and that's been the role that speculators have played. for centuries. It's also been true for a very long time that speculators, at least sometime, dampen the ups and downs of the market. That is, markets don't get too high or too low. The argument has always been, because once it gets too high, there'll be speculators coming in to drive it lower, and vice versa.
And of course, the idea there is that speculators are not stupid. They want to protect whatever it is they're investing.
Right, exactly.
Is there something about the American character that causes us to speculate in very different ways from our peers in other industrialized countries?
Whether that's true now, I couldn't say, but it's certainly true that in the 19th century, Americans were convinced that the U.S. was, people were much more speculative in the U.S. than elsewhere. And that was a common theme in the writings of foreign visitors to the United States. People from France or England would marvel at how quick Americans seemed to be to risk their money in all sorts of ventures.
Do we assess what was too risky only in hindsight? Because it seems to me that if people make a crazy bet on the stock market and win, everybody pats them on the back and nobody says, well, that was a crazy move. On the other hand, if they lose, we somehow disapprove of their choices.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's been, over time, efforts to limit the sorts of risks that people could take. People proposing various rules to limit the ability of people to take what seem like outlandish risks. But then, on the other hand, if you had started, Google or Microsoft or some company like that, that seemed like an outlandish risk at the time. And so that's always been the counterargument, is that if you prevent people from taking risks, we're going to lose the great benefits that that risk-taking provides.
How much is our ambivalence about this based around the fact that we don't think of speculators as actually creating anything? They put money into a market, maybe they facilitate the work of some other individual or corporation, but speculators who gain and lose money aren't making stuff.
Yeah, and that's been a ground of criticism of speculators for a long time. And so people have always said, well, look at say middlemen in a transaction, people who say transport a good from place A to place B, or people who do something to transform it, they're actually adding value, the argument goes. Whereas these speculators, all they're doing is buying and selling, they're shuffling assets around and so on, they're not adding any value. And so that has been the consistent economic argument against speculators. But there's always been an argument on the other side that speculators, in fact, are adding value. They are often the argument is that they are bearing risks that other people don't want to bear, so that the speculators in that way kind of like an insurance company that most people in the market don't want to bear risk. Most people want to shed risk. Well, that risk has to go to someone, and that someone, by and large, certainly in financial markets, is the speculator who makes a profit by being willing to bear that risk.
So as a society, we can approve or disapprove of speculation, but of course it's our government that we expect to step in and do something about it one way or another. What do we know about how the founders felt about investment?
Yeah, they were divided just the way people are today. There was a huge we would today call a crash, a stock market crash, in 1792. So right after the formation of the country, there was a big bubble and a big crash. Lots of people lost everything, and that gave rise to exactly the same sort of criticism of speculation that you see. You saw it, for example, after the recent financial crisis, after the great, the stock market crash of 1929, and so on. In fact, that's what actually got me started in this project. Is in the recent financial crisis a few years ago, I read lots of stuff in the media, just like everyone else did, about speculation. Was there too much speculation? Have we let our guard down? Have we deregulated, and so on? And the result is, too much speculation. And I realized, I had done some work regarding the U.S. crash of 1792, and then also an earlier bubble and crash in England in 1720, the South Sea bubble. And I realized that a lot of what you saw written in the last few years after the recent financial crisis was pretty much the same arguments on both sides that you saw in 1792 and 1720. I just thought, well, that's really curious. You know, we've learned so much in the 200, 300 years about economics, about how markets work, and yet you still see a lot of the same arguments, pro and con, because in the end, a lot of these arguments, they're really moral arguments rather than technical economic arguments.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is UCLA law professor Stuart Banner, whose new book is called Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. We are in our winter membership campaign. Doesn't feel very much like winter today. It's sort of nice out. A winter membership campaign, and we are calling on you to make a contribution of support to the station. It looks like we're looking for 17 new or renewing members in this hour. We have 14 to go. Thanks to those of you who have made a contribution without even being asked in this hour. If you'd like to join those good folks, you can go to kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. Stephen Becker is here now. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Chris. I feel fairly confident that we have at least 14 people listening who have not contributed yet during this drive. And if that's you, if you're a regular listener of the Think Show, it would be really great to be able to hear from you. We each drive, we have some different giveaways and some really cool thank you gifts available. And one that we've been talking around here in the office is we're all very excited about Snap Judgment coming to town at the end of February. It's a show, of course, you hear on the weekends here in KERA. And here's the thing. So the station has, for a one-time $60 contribution, you can get a ticket to see Snap Judgment when it's at the Majestic Theater on February 24th. But the station has this really select block of tickets that are kind of the primo tickets. And so if you not only want to see the show, but you want to be up close, you want to have the best sight lines in the theater, this is the gift for you. Again, that's for a $60 contribution. You'll have a ticket to see Snap Judgment when it's at the Majestic Theater on February 24th.
And as you might imagine, if you want to take a date or something, you can make a $120 contribution. It's scalable if you'd like to have
math
additional
on the radio.
Right, exactly. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to kera.org to make your contribution. You know that KERA is different from other radio stations. Another thing that's different about us is the way we fund programming here. But when you make a contribution to KERA, you're not simply just leaving the radio stream open for yourself to hear. You're certainly doing that. What you're also doing, though, is really contributing to the kind of journalism that you hear on KERA and on NPR and on the Texas State Collaborative. Your contribution of financial support is really an investment in journalism, which is something that many of you believe is vital. You want to understand what's happening in the world. You want a diverse selection of viewpoints presented. You want the news straight down the line rather than with a clear and evident partisan bias.
I think that's evident in some of the comments that we receive from people who do make contributions. Included in that is Kimberly Soto of Plano, who wrote in to say, I listen for the news, I listen for the entertainment, I listen to find out what's going on, what's new, what's exciting, and more than ever, I'm relying on you to bring me information I can trust. I can promise you that that's probably at the very tip top of the goals of what we do, is to be reliable and trustworthy, and to have listeners know when they tune into KERA that you know you are getting, as you said, Chris, the just unbiased, unvarnished truth. That's what we strive to do here, and the way we are able to do it is through your support. You are the ones that keep KERA commercial-free and, you know, make sure that the station can have nothing but full-time news programming. You can join the many others across the state who have made contributions during this drive at kera.org or give us a call at 888-694-6931.
It can be easy to take KERA for granted because it's sort of always been here when you've turned on the radio. But the reason it's been here is because somebody came along at some point in the past and made the contribution that put us here today so that you could discover us. Won't you join those supporters at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stuart Banner, who's professor of law at UCLA and author of a book called Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Stuart, you know that Abraham Lincoln was a major opponent of speculation. What brought him to that opinion of it, and what kind of investments did Lincoln believe crossed the line?
Yeah, so this was an episode during the Civil War. During the Civil War, particularly when the war was going badly for the North, the value of the dollar against gold plummeted. So a given amount of dollars was bought much less. Basically, and since the Union had to pay for the war in dollars, it made it a lot harder to fight the war. Lincoln was convinced that the reason why the dollar was declining in value was the concerted efforts of speculators. He thought that speculators were behind the dollar's decline. And so did a lot of important members of Congress. And so for a time during the Civil War, Congress actually prohibited speculation in gold for the reason, the idea was that that was what was causing the dollar to decline. Now, that, you know, as many other people pointed out at the time, that's just silly, that speculators cannot unilaterally force up or down the price of something for very long. Eventually, it's supply and demand in the market is what's going to ultimately determine the price. And so a group of the leading bankers in New York traveled down to Washington to talk to Lincoln and talk to members of Congress, and they managed to persuade Congress to repeal the ban on speculating in gold, which is within a few weeks after it had been enacted. And everyone realized afterwards it was a completely pointless exercise, that the ban in gold speculation did nothing to halt the decline of the dollar.
To what extent has the U.S. government relied on speculators to finance wars and other government activities?
Yeah, well, so the U.S., particularly during wartime, but really at all times, does a lot of financing by issuing bonds. There's an active secondary market in bonds. Without the presence of speculators willing to buy bonds, you know, ordinary investors, non-speculators, would be a lot less willing to buy bonds in the first place if they weren't confident there'd be someone down the line to sell to. So it's right to say that the government has always depended on speculators to help pay for the government. Same with corporations when they issue stock. You know, people have tried over the years to separate into two categories: genuine investors from speculators. But even if you could do that, the genuine investors would be much less likely to buy stock if they weren't confident that there'd be a speculators in the market later to buy it from them.
Some of our definition of whether speculation is gambling or investing certainly has changed over time. I was fascinated to read that there was a moment in American history when even life insurance was considered a little unseemly. These days we think of someone as irresponsible to not have it, but there was a time when it seemed crass.
Yeah, in the early years of life insurance, so the early 19th century, because life insurance is betting that someone's going to die, and that seemed a little creepy to a lot of people. It seemed kind of immoral to gamble on such a thing, and also raised the obvious worry that if someone has a financial stake in someone else dying, they might do something to help that along. And so, yeah, in the early years, and it wasn't the novelty of insurance generally, because insurance had been around for a long time. So there had been insurance on ship voyages, there had been fire insurance, and so on. But life insurance, the early life insurance companies had to overcome this this worry that gambling on people dying, it just didn't sit right with people.
These days, we might think of speculation as investing. We might think of it as gambling. But many people don't have a choice but to be directly involved. People who have any kind of company 401k, 403b, company stock investment plan have to play the market in order to retire.
Yeah, and that's actually something that's different about sort of today's period as compared to periods in the past. That is, you know, if you think about, say the big stock market crash in 1929, if you asked at the time what was the percentage of people who owned stock at the time, it was not very large. You know, it was the buying stock was really something for the by and large for the affluent. And you're right to point out today, you know, it's ubiquitous. Everyone, and not everyone, but lots of people, a very high percentage of people are involved in one way or another in the financial markets.
So when things are going really well, lawmakers are inclined to clear regulation out of the way. Can you give us some examples of how that's happened over time?
Yeah, you know, it's partly a matter of clearing regulation out of the way. I'd say it's more a matter of just not being real aggressive about enforcing existing regulations. Hmm. So there's a steady pattern of when markets are going up, government, you know, elected officials understandably don't want to be seen as spoiling the party. You know, they don't want to be seen as clamping down on something that is going well. Whereas when after a crash or during a recession, that's the time you see new financial regulation, and that's the time you see greater enforcement of existing regulations. So, you know, people may be familiar with the two big recent examples, which are after the crash of 29 and the you know, the start of the Great Depression. It was in the early 30s and with the first Roosevelt administration that you saw the real serious regulation of the financial markets that still exists today. And then similarly, after the recent financial crisis, there's various new forms of regulation that was enacted. But this is actually something quite old. And so the first, it was the South Sea bubble of 1720 in England that gave rise to the first systematic stock market regulation, actually quite strict stock market regulation in England right after that. And then the same with, you know, after the crash of 1792, in the United States, New York, which was the leading commercial state, passed some very strict stock market regulation right after that. So it's always been a pattern that new regulation comes after a crash, whereas during good times, the government kind of eases up.
So is it your opinion that new regulation is what causes investors to move somewhat more cautiously after a collapse, or is it the chastening of having lost so much money?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. I would say it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think it'd be hard to generalize about that. I think you'd have to look at each individual episode on its own.
Does speculation cause boom and bust cycles?
This is a topic of a debate that has gone on for centuries. And so the argument on one side is that speculators exacerbate boom and bust cycles by, you know, putting too much money in at the top and taking too much money out at the bottom. The counter argument has been no, speculators temper cycles by putting money in at the bottom, because that's when you can make money by buying things, and then taking money out at the top. I'm not sure. You know, again, that's one of those questions I think is very hard to generalize about. I think there may be specific instances of each.
So there have been real estate crashes in recent years. Lots of people are well familiar with the housing crash of 2008. I was interested to learn that real estate speculation has been troublesome in the past. Can you tell us about Florida in the mid-20s?
Yeah, so there have been real estate crashes before, and maybe one of the most well known, certainly the most colorful, took place in Florida in the 1920s. There was a huge Florida land boom. I mean, prices were were rising, at crazy rates. Partly I think it had to do with the widespread use of automobiles, which allowed people actually to get to Florida to go on vacation. But in any event, so Florida land prices were going up like crazy. There were all these speculators who were, buying parcels in the morning and then flipping them and selling them in the afternoon.
Wow.
for double the price. And nothing had yet been built on it. There's actually if anyone's ever seen the Marx Brothers movie, The Coconuts, that's the setting for the movie. Groucho Marx is one of these Florida land speculators. But then inevitably there was a big crash. A lot of these parcels became practically worthless. Some banks went out of business, and they were similar, but smaller but similar bubbles in other parts of the country at the time. But in turn, that was just. At the time, just the most recent bubble. There are similar bubbles. There was a big land bubble and crash in Southern California in the late 1800s when, again, same sort of thing. Speculators were flipping parcels for crazy profits for a time, and then the whole thing collapsed. That sort of thing has been kind of a staple of American history.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is UCLA law professor Stuart Banner, author of Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We're also on Twitter @KERAThink. We have 12 contributions still to go for the hour in order to stay on target for Think today. We started with a goal of 17, so we've heard from five of you. We are really grateful to those five. If you have not made a contribution of support to KERA, today's a great time to do it. Your dollars make it possible for us to have these conversations. If you are a regular listener to this program, this station, maybe you listen to Morning Edition every morning and All Things Considered as you drive home, you listen all weekend, your dollars make it possible for us to continue to provide the product and to grow the services that you use and rely on. We're not asking you to pay for anything that you don't use. And you can do it in a really easy way at 888-694-6931 or kera.org.
And this is an investment that is actually not risky, not a gamble at all, because I can promise you that when you contribute to KERA, the dollars that you send to the station are going directly to programming. They're going directly to support the shows, like you said, Morning Edition, like The Think Show, like All Things Considered, that you rely on here. Really, the only thing that would be risky is not making a contribution, because you would always want those shows to be here for you. The way they are is, of course, through your contribution. So it would be great if you could support those shows with a contribution at 888-694-6931, or you can go online at kera.org. We've got copies of Stuart Banner's book here, Speculation. If you would be like that for one of your thank you gifts, we would be happy to send you one.
It's available when you make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month as a sustainer, or you can do it all in one fell swoop for $120. It's a really interesting book if you have an interest in the financial markets. It's also just an interesting look at the way our culture has changed and our ideas about investment and gambling and speculation have changed over time. We'll talk a little bit after the break about the way that the courts have responded to things like insider trading and how that's evolved over the years. Really, really interesting history if you have, even $100 in the market. It's certainly a great read. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number if you'd like to become a member of KERA right now. You can also do it online at kera.org. So much talk these days about people concerned about their sources of news and information. You probably feel great because you found public radio, you found KERA, you can turn on the radio here. And I heard somebody say this morning, you don't have to fact check what you hear on KERA, but the thing is, you could.
I think we would welcome that.
Everything would match up. So, we're doing our best. Nobody's perfect, but we're trying very hard to bring you precise, accurate information. If a mistake is made, to correct it, we try to bring in multiple viewpoints on different topics. Sometimes that may delight you, and sometimes it may really frustrate you, but that's reality. And you know, I really feel like KERA is radio for adults, people who can understand that things, the events of the world are not always going to jibe with how we think the world is supposed to work, but we all want to know the truth of how it's actually happening. And that's the benefit of, you know, supporting, philanthropically supporting a journalistic organization like KERA.
And the beauty of listening to KERA is I have it on pretty good authority that those facts are actually checked before you hear it on the air.
Yes,
so that's
they are.
Really the best part.
Yes.
We have a goal this hour of hearing from 17 listeners. And the good news is that we are more than halfway there. We'd have just 8 to go. It would be great to hear from those 8 folks at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. And the reason that we make these little micro goals is to just make sure that the drive is moving along at a reasonable momentum. We had a really great day yesterday, and it would be very good if we could continue that pace today. And that's just going to make sure that things wrap up in a reasonable manner, and it'll be nothing but programming when you tune in to KERA. You can be the next person to help us take one more step towards that goal when you contribute at kera.org, or you can call us at 888-694-6931. If you need a little extra incentive, we have, of course, a lot of cool thank you gifts during this drive. Might we recommend the Think Lunch Tote, which we are, of course, fond of here in the studio. It's a really cool mesh. You know, it's got a padded mesh handle. It's got a shoulder strap. You can have hot things in there, cold things in there, whatever you need. It's around the time, you know, when you do a show from noon to two, lunch is kind of like on the back burner, but
it doesn't mean
we don't think about it. And we've been thinking about it extra by looking at this picture of the Think Tote.
That may explain why the Think Lunch Tote, it's like extra large. So if you're someone who likes, like, you know, cold packs in your lunch, but you can't quite fit them in your thing, this will solve all those problems. It's frankly big enough that you could do a little picnic for you and some friends, and you'd still be able to fit a really good amount of food. It's not enormous, but it's a generous size. And it's probably because the entire staff is very hungry from noon to two every day.
It says it holds up to 16 cans. If you can eat 16 cans of something on your lunch break, I am very impressed. So this is for just $10 a month on the sustaining gift plan. You can take a look at what it looks like over at kera.org, which is, of course, where you can make that contribution.
Your contribution of support goes right to work, providing you with the kind of programming that, you know, frankly, maybe you've been listening to for years and letting somebody else come along and pay for. It's really so easy to set up a sustaining membership at a modest amount that adds up for this station and provides every bit, every dollar's worth of value to you and your life. kera.org to make your contribution, or 888-694-6931. Counting down from 10, get us to 7. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with UCLA law professor Stuart Banner, author of Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Stuart, these days, even people who have no money in the markets, no particular interest in the markets, know that insider trading is the sort of thing that lands one in jail. Has it always been that way?
No, in fact, it used to be the opposite. That is, it used to be for a long time that insider trading was just the smart thing to do. That is, you know, what better way to speculate in companies than the people who ran the companies, who knew them best. And so it was thought to be that was just a prudent thing for a person involved with a corporation to do. And it was thought to be that's part of the compensation, basically, that you get for running a company. Is you get to make money from your advanced knowledge of what the company is going to do. That's an idea that came under more and more criticism over the course of the 20th century, you know, because it's part of a broader change in the law. That is, it used to be that it was just fine to make money from your superior knowledge in all sorts of ways. So if you made a product and you knew it was defective, you know, that's okay. As long as you didn't lie about it, you could just sell it. And, you know, that was the buyer's problem. And well, there are a lot of areas of law that used to be like that. And then that gradually all changed in the 20th century to the point where now, you know, you get disclosures of all sorts of things, you know. So if you, you know, get a new credit card or a new phone plan or whatever, there's these voluminous disclosures, because now the assumption is that you're not supposed to take advantage of your superior information to take advantage of other people in the market. And so investing, speculating was part of that. And so gradually in the middle decades of the 20th century, insider trading shifted from being a normal, accepted corporate practice to being, to being illegal.
So, hence, Martha Stewart went to jail for insider trading.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think she went to jail for lying about the insider trading. But in any event, the point is right. The broader point is right, that what Martha Stewart did would have been people would have applauded that a century earlier. People would have said, "Oh, that's a very sensible thing to do."
So, is this progress or a limitation?
Well, it's both. I mean, it's progress in the sense of I think it caused more people to be confident in entering the market. So it used to be that, you know, before insider trading was illegal, it was a staple of advice books. They would say, do not try to enter the stock market because you'll be competing with people who have insider information. They're going to know more than you. You're going to get fleeced. And so by removing the pot that, well, by making insider trading illegal, that took that danger away. And so it allowed ordinary people to enter the market.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First on the line is Paul in Plano. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I would describe myself as a chastened speculator in the sense that I've done well some years. Some years I haven't done so well. This year I'm doing fairly well. And if your guest has any way to help me to continue to do well, I'd appreciate it. But here's my comment. My comment is the IRS helps me because it allows me to take $3,000 every year in short-term losses and to roll over. If I have more than $3,000 in short-term losses, it allows me to roll those over and roll them over indefinitely until I can take them all. So I get a little help from the IRS in my speculation. My question, though, is, would you consider there to be a personality type that tends to be more of a speculator than an investor? Because I think my personality may predispose me to be one of those kind of people that I just have to speculate as opposed to invest, because I tend to want to do things on a more short-term basis. I want to see the results now as opposed to waiting for an extended period of time before I get my game.
So you're comfortable with risk, Paul, is what you're saying?
Yes, yes.
What do you think,
Stuart? Yeah, I mean, there's certainly different sorts of people in their attitudes toward risk. So some people are risk averse, you know. Some people are risk preferring, like yourself. And then there are people in the middle who are neutral toward risk. And I think you're right that accounts for some pretty big differences in people's behavior. I want to get back, if you don't mind, to the point you made about the IRS helping you along. That's actually that is one small part of a very interesting story, which is, you know, how the tax rules can have big effects on speculative markets. And so it's always been but as long as there's been an income tax, so 100 years, there's been debates about what to do, what the tax treatment of speculators ought to be. Should we make tax, you know, for example, should we have lower capital gains rates than ordinary income rates? Well, wait a minute, will that just promote speculation and so on? And, you know, if we're going to have different rates, well, is there some way of giving the the preferential rates to so-called genuine investors without giving them also to the speculators and so on. That's been a big topic of debate for a century now.
It would seem that, you know, if we change the rules, remove them or stop enforcing them or create new ones, according to what has happened in the markets, we're always sort of operating on a bit of a lag, right? Those things Yep. happen in response to a change in the markets. Is it realistic, though, to craft something that is intended to be a permanent set of regulations, or are we better off sort of continually refining the rules?
Well, it's hard to say what the permanent set of regulations would be because speculation has benefits, it has costs. Different people have different opinions about the balance of benefits and costs. You know, when times are good, the benefits seem more obvious, the costs seem less obvious, and then vice versa when times are bad. So it's in principle, it would be nice to say, yes, let's have just a set of rules and make them impervious to whether the market is going up or going down. But it's easy to say in the abstract. The hard thing is to figure out what those rules would be.
And, of course, there are risks to politicians trying to time their own opinions and positions on these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the way to get votes is to criticize speculators after a crash and then to not criticize them when the market's going well.
Did you go into this project hoping that you would be able to find a clear line somewhere between gambling and investment?
No. I went into it in large part because I was frustrated by the claims of people who were quite so certain about what was good and what was bad. And I, you know, thinking, you know, this is a much harder, more intractable problem than you realize.
Why do we want a definition?
Well, because everyone wants to know what's right, what's wrong. I mean, just to give you one example, so the Super Bowl's coming up every year. That's the most wagered upon event in the United States. But wagers in most states, wagers on sporting events are unenforceable. That is, there's nothing legal that the loser can do to make nothing legal that the winner can do to make the loser pay if the loser doesn't pay. Whereas it's completely different with bets on, say, the price of stock or the movements of interest rates or currencies or something like that. And so people always say, well, why is that? What's the difference? What's the difference between the two? And people have had different attitudes about that over time. So in the early United States, bets on horse races and card games and such, those were enforceable. The winner could sue the loser and force the loser to pay, whereas judges would refuse to enforce stock transactions that they thought were too risky. And then, of course, now we've got the exact opposite situation.
Stuart Banner is professor of law at UCLA. His new book is called Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing. Stuart, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to thank all of you listening today, those of you who participated in the show, and those of you who have participated in KERA programming by supporting it with your dollars. Your money functions a little bit like a subscription. It functions a little bit like an investment in the kind of radio that you want to hear, the kind of journalism that you believe is important in our world today. Your contribution at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931 goes to work, continuing the kind of work that you hear on KERA that you maybe have tuned in for years to listen to. Stephen Becker is here now. Hey, Stephen.
I am. And Chris, we've been hearing from a number of people this hour who have heeded the call of making sure that we hear from 17 KERA listeners. We're getting very close to ticking off the last check mark on that goal and making sure that the goal is reached. We'll let you know when we get there. But some of the people we have heard from are, we got a pledge from Dallas, one from Euless, one from Granbury. We also heard from William Werner of Irving, who wrote in to say that more than ever, I need a reliable source of news and information. That's been kind of a constant theme from listeners we've heard from during this drive. And also Daniel Radich of Allen and Andrea Moore of Keller, who said that KERA provides unbiased news and content. Well, that's what we strive to do, but we can only do it with your support. You can make sure that the station has the funding that is necessary in order to be sure that the programming and the news content that you rely on so heavily is there for you every day by giving us a call at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
A lot of people these days are thinking about the importance of actually taking action for the causes you believe in, for the things that you think should happen in the world, whether that means volunteering at an organization that you think is doing really good work or running for political office instead of just, you know, talking about politicians. Taking action somehow in a fundamental way, more than just, you know, clicking like. And I think it's the same thing with, you know, nurturing your public radio station. Taking action for KERA ultimately is even better for KERA than just you listening. We are so happy you're here. But if you can afford to make a contribution, maybe you can be that last person. We were waiting on one, literally one contribution in order to make the goal for this hour. Maybe you can be that person. And for the rest of the year, every time you turn on KERA and hear an interesting story or something that makes you happy or sad or angry, you can think, I did that. I helped to pay for that piece of journalism.
And not only did you help to pay for it for yourself, you helped pay for it for anyone who wants to listen to KERA, regardless of maybe their particular ability to contribute at this time. We actually got a really nice note from a listener a couple of days ago who said, you know, she really wished that she could contribute, but right now is not quite the right time for her. Hey, we totally understand that. All we ask is that you can contribute what you can afford. And if we hear from all of our listeners to make that exact contribution, that would be more than fine, and we would be more than appreciative. You can make that contribution, of course, at kera.org, where you can check out all of the thank you gifts that are available during this drive. Might we recommend the Think logo mug, which we are particularly partial to? I use one every single day of the week. It's this really cool black mug with the Think logo on the outside of it, of course. That's just $5 a month on the sustaining plan, or a $60 one-time gift, or if you want, you can get the Texas Standard mug, which of course comes on at 10 o'clock every day here on KERA. Now, this is interesting. That's for $6 a month. There's a $72 one-time gift.
Yeah, we're the hometown act. Yes, we're going to give you a bargain.
Think is the bargain basement of thank you gifts. But actually,
it's a great looking mug.
I think our mug is, I'm just going to say, it's a little cooler looking. But, you know, whatever. Whatever. We want you to take the mug. That is your choice. You can take a look at both of them over at kera.org.
Maybe you've never made a contribution to public radio and you've heard people talking for years and wondered who in the world is giving money to KERA when you can just turn it on and hear it. I understand that. I for one, am famous for imagining the worst possible pain of an untested scenario. And then once I actually do something, I realize that was not so bad. You know, so you try something for the first time and you realize, oh, not only was it not so bad, but it feels great. It's for many people, it's a little bit surprising how great it feels to become a supporting member of a public radio station. KERA is your public radio station, and we are set up to allow you to easily make a contribution in a large amount or in a small amount or somewhere in between so that it suits your budget. With the sustaining membership plan, it's a monthly transfer from your debit account or your credit card into KERA's membership account. It's really easy to do $20, $30, even $50 a month to KERA. It adds up to a lot at the end of a year, but it doesn't necessarily really, you know, strain the budget too much when you break it up like that.
Yeah, that sustaining member plan, I mean, more and more people are choosing that every drive. And actually, to pull back the curtain a little bit, we've been kind of slightly lowering the goals that we've been asking for in a particular drive because so many people have chosen that sustaining plan. It really works well for people. You know that you're supporting KERA throughout the year. And when you hear these membership campaigns like this, you know, well, my donation already got sent in this month. It's taken care of. I didn't even have to think of it. It really works well for a lot of listeners, and it probably would work well for you. You can find out all about how to set that up at kera.org, or if you'd like somebody to walk you through it, there's somebody who would be very happy to do that at 888-694-6931.
Your contribution matters. Thank you.